We convene this Monday, May 2nd, 2005 session of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. Mr. Britton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I just quickly like to review the week's proposed agenda. Today we're going to hear from the Seniors and People with Disabilities cluster, hear more about the Phase 2 budget presentation. As I understand it from Mr. Taves, we probably will not need to use our presentation books, but he's going to go over a number of questions that were asked, I guess, last week and back in Phase 1. Is that right? Yes. And then tomorrow, May 3rd and Wednesday, May 4th, we have scheduled right now public testimony, and we'll put up signs tomorrow, but just to let everybody know, there will be two overflow rooms. People are welcome to come here, of course, but then also we'll have TVs set up in H170 and the orientation room next to the kiosk. So two overflow rooms. And again, public testimony on both May 3rd and May 4th. With that, I'll turn it back to you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Taves.
Happy May, everybody.
Same to you.
It'll be a great month.
Busy.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, James Taves from the Department of Human Services, the Senior and Disabilities Program. What I thought I'd do today, Mr. Chairman, is go over some of the key questions and issues that have been raised last week, as well as finishing up some of the areas that you wanted us to revisit during Phase 1, and then go to the spreadsheet with the programs, the costs, if that's satisfactory. Mm-hmm. So let me first start with a series of questions. You asked us last week to talk about the position changes, that why the budget had been going down and the position count was actually going up by about 400. We went back, Mr. Chairman, to 2001 and sort of walked through the positions and the puts and takes from that point forward. In 2001, the reorganization of the department took place, and the long-term care cluster then brought together the senior and physical disability program, the developmental disabilities program, and the disability determination unit that does the eligibility for the Social Security Administration. We started out in the legislatively approved budget with all of those things combined at about 2,289 positions. During the reorganization, then, about 769 positions left the cluster, but many of those went to other parts of the department. About 108 positions went to, and this will be very brief. I just want to sort of walk you how we got to the point we're at. About 108 positions went to department-wide support services, so budget contract functions and a lot of the administrative functions went elsewhere in the department. We also transferred at that time about 492 positions, which were the state positions in our field offices, because again, our field in long-term care is organized through a combination of local government and councils on government, largely AAAs. And then for those parts of the state where local government does not operate the program, we have state field offices. All of those state field offices were originally put under a different cluster called Community Human Services at that time, along with self-sufficiency, child welfare, vocational rehabilitation, and all the different programs. Starting in the subsequent biennium, we actually brought that part of the field back. So those positions then transferred back into the senior and disability program. So that really shows why we had those swings of positions. They weren't new positions. They were just positions that had gone to different parts of the department. When we finished 2003-2005, we were at about 1,632 positions in the SPD cluster, again, starting from what I mentioned, 2,289. But then going into 2003-2005, the 470 positions in the field came back. At November e-board, this last November e-board, we were at 2,096 positions. And then in the governor's recommended budget, we're at 1965, I believe, are the number of positions in the GRB. So again, it wasn't a net increase. It were simply positions changing places within the department.
Okay. Let me take just a second and go back to my numbers because my recollection was that we were talking about, you know, 1,800. We went up to 2,200 and we came down to 2,000. But and you're saying that that well, I guess so I got lost on that. Have you looked at all this?
You're getting nods from the back of the room in terms of the FTE.
And Mr. Chairman, I would be happy to share. We put together a very detailed chart of all the puts and takes of the positions and where they went and how they came back, et cetera, and we'd be very happy to share that. And I think it matches up all, to the numbers then we have in the spreadsheet here in terms of the aggregate numbers. But it's a good way of showing all
that to us. If we take a look at that, then that's fine. We don't need to go into it further in the course of this hearing.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you for clarifying what happened.
Then, Mr. Chairman, we were going to revisit this chart, which is page 5A in the book in phase 2, and I think that was inserted back in the book.
What page?
Page 5 in phase 2. We replaced, there were quite a few questions last Thursday about what happened to all the people in the reductions in the level cuts from last biennium.
James.
I'm sorry.
We'll get there in a sec. But also, this handout, some of you have this in your books if your books were here. But are you going to review that as
just
well?
Just very briefly, yes.
Okay.
And, Mr. Chairman, there were a lot of questions last Thursday about this chart. So we cleaned this chart up, took some of the interim dates out so you could really look at the totals beginning when the reductions occurred, and then a little over a year later at November rebalance 2004. And, again, on the first page are the reductions in levels 15 through 17. There were questions why in some cases the numbers actually increased, whether that was people that left service and then came back into service. And again, going back and looking through all the notes, in many cases, this is simply people that were reassessed. In some cases, they were cut from services, but they then appealed, and they would have aid paid pending, meaning they would retain their service and their eligibility until they go all the way through a contested case hearing. But that's all the puts and takes in terms of the total number of people that were reduced and then what service categories they ended up in.
Okay, let's just stand by just for a second.
I apologize. Are we...
We've got lots of page 5s in here. Sorry.
Yeah. Okay, the red tab is page 2, and it's page 5 after the red tab.
Not in what we got last time.
Here you go.
See, if you keep your book in a disheveled fashion, you can get right to it.
And if you haven't been here to keep your book, it's pretty heavy.
Yeah, it's organized, right. So you can't find it.
Thank you.
All right. So again, Mr. Chairman, on page 1 are the first round of cuts, which was levels 15 through 17. Those reductions, termination notices went out February of 2003 to 3,231 clients. It shows where they were at the time of the reduction and then where they ended up a little over a year later. And the same thing. And then we've tried to bullet all of the explanations of why people ended up in the categories that they did. Same thing for levels 12 through 14. The reductions went out in April 1st of 2003, and it also shows where people ended up in service. So I hope that cleans that up. I'll be happy to answer any more questions about that.
Okay, just for one clarification, then Representative Hansen, just a second. We're looking at 1,643. These are the same folks. There are other people that obviously would have come in to the system after April or so of 03.
Correct.
But this is just tracking that one population of 1,643 people.
Correct.
Okay, Representative Hansen.
I'm trying to track this. Of February of 03, we had 1,071 people that were notified they were no longer receiving services, and then that number grew to 1,263 by the next November.
No, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, if you look at the first page, levels 15 through 17, on February 1 of 2003, 3,231 people got termination notices.
Mm-hmm.
Of that number, then you look at the top, no services, that's the number of people that ended up in no service at all. So they simply okay. disappeared from our service system. Of the 3,231 that remained in our service system, who remained as of February when the reduction went out, and then a year and a half later, does that...
Okay.
So it's the same people.
Okay. I'm just wondering if 850 were reassessed into higher priority levels, why the number with no services grew?
Because, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, in some areas the number actually reduced. For example, in personal care,
okay.
Medical only, people that were on OHP only. So those numbers should balance to the bottom column. So in some cases it grew, in some cases it shrunk.
Okay. I think I'm tracking.
Okay.
Any other questions on these charts? Thank you.
Then, Mr. Chairman, I was going to take some time on the cap. It was a lot of issues were raised relative to the cap last week, and you asked us to more clearly identify what actions you think the department would take to impose a cap, how long people might be expected to wait. We have a handout that I think Mr. Britton is going to give to you. Mr. Chairman, we've obviously stamped draft in very large letters here because, again, as we indicated last Thursday, we have an extensive planning process that we will have to go through. If, in fact, we impose the cap would be set for January of 2006, and we would involve our field and our stakeholders and consumers in this process. What we anticipate, again, going back to the discussion from last Thursday, this is not an absolute cap where no new people come in. It is a cap where the total number of enrollments are held steady, but then within that amount, in terms of natural turnover and deaths and the capacity that naturally occurs under that cap, we would rank people by the critical need that they have for services in terms of who gets in first and who gets in later. What we've indicated, if you look at the second paragraph at intake and risk criteria, we believe, and again, I think the planning process will bear that out, that people that should get immediate entry would be those people with the most complex needs, probably in levels 1 through 4 or so, who need virtually total assistance with eating and toileting and mobility and all of those critical things. Secondly, people that are at very high risk due to very complex medical needs, and that includes daily monitoring or assessment by nurses, people with unstable medical conditions, people dependent on medical technology or equipment. The other people we believe would have immediate access are those that are, who are at immediate risk of physical harm because of a protective services investigation. Those are kinds of the folks that we believe that we would authorize service for on an immediate basis. Then the other individuals that either have some in-home supports or family or something like that, we would triage, put on a waiting list. we expect, or I shouldn't say we expect, we hope people would not have to wait more than between 90 and 120 days, that we could move through most individuals that are waiting within a six-month period. That will depend, again, on where we set the cap, what the caseload forecast will bring in to both the rebalance and the governor's reshoot, and then what that capacity will be within the cap. We believe, and again, this is on some initial inquiries that we've made of turnover, that we need about somewhere between 200 to 300 cases per month to fit people into these critical categories, and then the others would be triaged later on a waiting list. But again, that exact ebb and flow we have not determined at this point.
Okay, this is a very important discussion because there's been a lot of questions about, you know, such as, do you mean that even if you're seriously disabled, you'll be left without the ability to enter the program all because we're starting with the existing population, which may have people that are much less seriously disabled? And what I'm understanding you to say is that if there were 100 people who qualified to come in, even if the cap, say the cap's at 21,000, if at that point there would be 21,100 because they were qualified to come in, but then because of either improvement or death or whatever, the first 100 people that are in the existing population that no longer are in that population, then the 100 that have come in because of their condition would be there, and so now we come back to the cap level. I mean, so whatever the cap level is, it's going to be fairly stable, although there may be rises because of the condition of people that need to come in. Am I correct in that?
Basically, Mr. Chairman, that is correct. The cap, again, would be the total number of enrollments, and then people would be new people enrolled on the home and community-based waiver would come in within that number as there's an estimated capacity of vacancies, discharges, deaths every month. And again, we estimate that probably somewhere between 200 to 300 cases we would need within that cap on a regular basis to triage in people with the most critical needs.
Okay, so the most serious people will be able to come in irrespective of the cap, although over time, I mean, that'll all be averaged
right
out, but they would be able to come in. Representative Hansen.
What's the average number of people that go off the list now for the various?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, I believe it was, I mean, very roughly about the 200 to 300 number, but again, we have to update that with all the caseload forecasts, and we'll have that data shortly.
Okay, if you've got 200 to 300 people that are coming off the list each month, and then you've got 200 or 300 that are going, because of critical issues, go on the list, it seemed to me that if you didn't have the critical issues, the waiting list would be very, very long, because even in effect the people with the most needs are always going to the head of the list. They're not actually going to be on the waiting list, but they're going to use up the capacity that's being created on a monthly basis.
Julia just handed me, Mr. Chairman, some data in terms of the current caseload without a cap. Is we typically have about 800 people in a month and about 400 people out, but that's been based on growing caseloads over time. And again, now with a cap, we would not, the number of people coming in and going out would have to be held relatively constant. So to your issue, Representative Hansen, on whether some people with less impairments end up being on a waiting list for a very long time, it's our hope that won't occur, that even over a six-month period or so that those people will become eligible as well. But that will really depend on where we set the cap and how much capacity we have within that cap.
Okay. Other questions? Senator Winters, and we're
sure
glad
you
to have you with us today.
Well, thank you. Glad to be back with you. Just a question. It would be helpful for me if you gave us some information that showed the trend lines and what's happening over a period of years, because it's my understanding that it's growing. It's not retracting, and if that's true, where you place the cap becomes extremely critical, and also some projections of what we anticipate as growth, future growth. I think we all have agreed that We're becoming more chronological in the state, including myself. So it would be very, very helpful if we could see, I'm a very visual person, some graphics that show some patterns and where this is heading before you talk about where a cap should be. That would be very helpful. That is a good point.
We could the number is going to be as of the end of this year, I mean, as far as what the cap would be. But it would be valuable to see, of the 800 that come in each month, what number of them would be determined critical needs, because maybe it's 150, or maybe, and so that we could see how it might project out over just a few years. A decision has to be made. We understand that, but we'd like to have it be as an informed a decision as possible.
Madam Chair, and excuse me, Mr. Chairman, Senator Winters, I. So used to calling her Madam Chair for so many years. Senator Winters, we will have a reforecast of the caseload that will be coming in both as part of the rebalance and then the reshoot of the governor's budget. So that will actually show the trend lines and where we would expect the caseload to go without a cap, and then we'll have to make a decision on if we set that cap, where exactly the number would be. So I think you'll see that trend line come in the caseload forecast.
Okay, you're saying so we need to wait until the reshoot to get the information, but actually we could get not only what is in the reshoot, but also what is specifically relevant to this discussion?
Mr. Chairman,
we'd like to know.
Correct.
Because we won't show those that would qualify regardless of the cap in the reshoot. Then you're going to have to prepare that for us.
Mr. Chairman, the reshoot will show the overall caseload and the trend line. And if we then make a decision that as of January or 06, we would peg where the caseload would be expected to be at that point and hold the enrollments, and then we could estimate above that line how many people would not get service, mm-hmm. except for those with critical needs that would come in over time. So I think we'll be able to display that visually.
It's important that you add that other piece, which is your estimate, to talk about, because we deal now prospectively in dealing with this budget of what you think, based on trend lines, will be the population at risk.
And, Mr. Chairman, we've never done a cap before, so, I mean, this is, we don't know exactly how this would, in fact, work. We can only make the best guesses right now and then do some real detailed planning here in the coming months.
Just to make the kind of the obvious plain, as the pie of $12.393 billion is ultimately determined, you know, what the split should be, the huge discussion now is education. And I just want to make sure that our committee is fully advised as to what the consequences will be if, based on different scenarios. And I certainly think these co-chairs will want to know that information as well. And so the better information we can have relating to the populations that will be affected by less funding for human services, the better information they can have in making that ultimate decision as to how to divide the pie. Okay. So that's why we need the information. Just a moment, Mr. Britton. Well, Representative Hannah and then Mr. Britton.
Well, this is just a thought, and Mr. Taves, I might have misunderstood. Isn't the total within that group around 22 or 25,000? Isn't that the projection for the end of the year, 25,000?
I think the original cap estimate in the governor's recommended budget was
21,000.
21,500, well, something like that.
If you think about it that way, this kind of plan might work fairly well for about 5 years, depending on the number of people coming in that are in the critical care group, because after that, you would take the entire population of the 21,000 people, and over a five-year period, more and more and more, until at the end of five and a half years, the entire population would be in the critical care group, wouldn't they? I mean, if you just sort of
theoretically,
if you just do the math and you keep the group the same size and you have normal in and out, pretty soon the entire pool would be in the more severe care.
It has to be revisited.
Right. So we're going to have to be looking ahead. Otherwise, what you're going to do is take that pool and put everybody in the pool in the immediate care group over some time.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hannah, I mean, that's a very good point. Already when we cut levels 14 through 17, over time you're going to see more people in probably in 24-hour care, people at higher impairment levels, and cost per case is going to go up within that group. But we could not set a cap and extend that cap out 2, 3, 4 biennia, because I think what would then happen is you'd get a lot of people with lesser impairments, but their impairment levels would escalate as you didn't provide service, and so we would ironically be finding even more people in that critical care category because we hadn't provided any preventative or limited in-home or something else that would have allowed them to get by for longer periods of time. So
there's a lot of things that can change. The federal government is, as a rule of thumb, saying the youngest generation at this point ought to consider living 15 years longer than the current generation because of medical advances that have not yet been made. And so with pharmacology breakthroughs and other medical advances that are going through with research right now, it could really change the quality of life for the elderly, which means they may not need to have this care as much as they might have before, but it'll also extend the life, and then it comes down to how long is the last phase, the final phase of life, and those are things that we can't answer at this point.
And again, Mr. Chairman, when we started in phase one, we talked about the aging trends. The biggest cohort in the increase are people over 85, so increasingly this population will be more frail, much older, and that will begin to skew our service delivery as well significantly over time.
Mr. Britton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. James, have you given any thought on who does the triaging? Is this going to be a centralized process or out in the field?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Britton, we really have not had the detailed discussions on how this will be operationalized. We're assuming that certain cases with clear criteria would be approved at a local level, and probably then we'd have, as you go up and down the triaging line, we would have to have different ways of reviewing who gets in and how that looks like. I think it would be a combination of field decision and a combination at the central office. If part of the issue with the federal government will be that if we're triaging people and we're putting people who otherwise are eligible for Medicaid on waiting lists, we have to treat people equally statewide.
Exactly.
So we couldn't simply give an allocation, I don't want to call it slots, but say to a local area, you can triage 20 or 30 people in a month, if in fact that looked much different than a different part of the state. And so people with like needs statewide have to be treated fairly in the same way. So it's not simply a field decision. It will have to be a combination of both field and central office. Mr. Chairman, moving on, there was a question last Thursday about how many people with income cap, and I think Representative Hannah asked, how many people with income cap trusts are in nursing facilities, and we just did a quick count. We have 1,302 people that have income cap trusts. That means they've used trusts to make themselves eligible within the 300% of SSI and the asset test. And of that number, 517 are in nursing facilities.
So that's about 5% of the population.
In nursing facilities. Correct, of Medicaid-funded beds, about.
Okay. Where's that even here?
It is on.
Huh?
Could I clarify that,
Mr. Chair?
Please, Mr. Brooks. Okay, how many people are in nursing facilities, about?
In Medicaid beds, about 5,000, roughly 5,000.
And of those, 517 have income cap trusts.
Correct.
So a little better than 10%. Okay.
But of the total population, 20 some odd thousand. 1,000 have the caps?
Well, the 21,000 is the home and community based waiver. That's just the people in community services, in ALFs and residential care, foster care, in home. That excludes people in nursing homes, so you add another 5,000 to that, and we're up at roughly 30,000, somewhere in that neighborhood of total caseload of seniors and people with disabilities.
That would be eligible to use, what is it, the Miller Cap Trust? Is that what they call it?
Ms.
30,000 and 1,300 are using it.
Correct.
So you're talking down 3-4% of the total population.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Westland. It's not widely used as some people would think, but it is used, and some people with income above that can access it.
Yeah, and you know that's to be expected, because if 80% of the elderly's care needs are being presently covered by family and loved ones, relatives, friends, now we're dealing with the remaining 20%, and those are most likely, in most cases, to be those that are in the greatest need, I'm guessing, because they don't have the family support, they don't have the other support. And so of that 20%, now we're dealing with what percentage actually have the money, but for whatever reason are going to get around it. I mean, there's so many factors entering into it.
Correct. Moving on, Mr. Chairman, the other major issue that was raised, you asked us to go back and think through how many assisted living facilities could be at financial risk if we implement the rate change as recommended in the governor's recommended budget. Again, we indicated that of the 43 or so facilities that are funded by the housing agency through general obligation bonds, about half that number could be at risk. We then estimate probably another half again, or another 20 to 30 of those that are not funded by the bond are potentially at risk. Again, we don't know the financing or the financial portfolio of each of these organizations, but essentially when you look at facilities that don't have a lot of residents and are very high Medicaid users, and often those are in rural areas, I think the financial pressure on them with a 30% rate reduction will be the most significant. We actually, Mr. Chairman, we have a list of facilities by capacity and the Medicaid census, if that would be helpful. But we can only speculate because, again, we don't know the broader financial portfolio of some of these organizations.
Okay, Mr. Tave, we have a question by Representative Hannah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you say the numbers one more time, the total number of facilities?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hannah, there are 190 assisted living facilities, and of that number, probably 40 or 50 could experience some significant financial risk.
Thank you.
Senator Williams.
We dealt with this issue a couple of sessions ago. It would be helpful, I think, if you could get from Housing and Community Development the actual number from them that that we actually have responsibility for as a state that's under the bond, and two, they can probably tell us of those that are at risk and where they're located in the state. I think that members, that would be helpful information for the members, and what would be a rate structure that would not put them at risk.
That'd be great information. I don't know.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Winters, I believe we gave to the committee a detailed analysis from the housing agency. If we did not, we have that. We've had quite a few discussions with them on which programs they believe are even at risk right now and would be put at risk if the rate change goes through. So I know we have that. If we have not supplied it, we will certainly do that.
Okay. Ms. Britton.
Mr. Chair, I have some materials from the Department of Housing, and I will be happy to get them to all members of the subcommittee.
Thank you.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Mr. Britton, do you have them by location?
Yes.
Okay. Other questions? Mr. Tate.
Mr. Chairman, there were some additional questions posed about the state-operated community program, whether people are assessed on an annual basis for their capacity to potentially leave and then be replaced by other individuals. We did go back and discuss that at length. We do have a very detailed annual assessment process. I think we described right now there are 7 or 8 people that are scheduled for relocation, assuming we find the community placement where they could move to in the last biennium.
Okay, now wait a second. So we're talking about
state-operated community programs. These are the 146 people in state-operated programs at the high cost.
Okay. Now I'm back with you. So would you, again, now tell me out of that 146 what you're finding?
Mr. Chairman, the question was whether we do a detailed annual assessment of those people and whether they're capable of living in a different community program at lesser expense? And the answer is yes, we do a fairly detailed annual assessment. It's something that's required by federal law as well. And right now of that group, and I think I mentioned this last time, we have seven or eight people that have been recommended to be relocated to different community programs where we're in the process of looking where they can be transferred to, and that's the plans are developed, the work is going on with their families, and et cetera. In the last biennium, four people left the state-operated program, two people passed away, so there was a net change of six, seven scheduled now. The other issue is then, can we decrease the capacity of the high-cost program? And the discussion last time was every slot that opens up in this program, we usually have a waiting list of people that are coming in from other critical places. And just looking at the last several admissions, the last admissions within the last period of months were from the intensive care unit at Oregon Health Sciences University, one from Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center with critical mental health needs. A person came in from Oregon State Hospital out of the forensic unit with a criminal background, and two people came in from jails, one from the Umatilla County Jail, one from the Marion County Jail. So, again, typically people are coming out of pretty intense environments or incarcerated kind of settings that need some pretty extraordinary supervision for public safety in the community.
Senator Westland?
Go ahead.
We both had the same kind of startled from jails kind of response. What kind of planning are you doing, working with Nichol and his group, because you're talking mental health and some of that and the planning for how we address those issues that where you've got both the individual who may have been going to or should have been going to the state hospital or in other venues, are they showing up in your state operated group home? I think that is an area of discussion, and if so, why?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Winters, they show up from multiple places. People that come in, adults now, we're talking adults with developmental disabilities that are adjudicated and then placed under the Psychiatric Security Review Board, they either are conditionally released to the community, in which case we then have to put a plan that has to be approved by the Psychiatric Security Review Board for their placement in the community. Many of them never come into the state-operated program. They'll go into some other community program. We may provide some extra staffing or resources to make sure that they're safe. Some of them then end up, because they're too dangerous, cannot be conditionally released, go for a period of time into the forensic ward at Oregon State Hospital. We then plan for their eventual release under a conditional release. Some of those individuals then come straight into our state-operated program, and others also then, with less dangerous needs from our perspective, go into other community programs. It's part of our mandated caseload. We actually do regular planning in our budget for an estimate of people that will come through that process. But then we also have individuals that come through our doors from unexpected places. They're just adjudicated locally for some crime. They end up in a local jail. They may not have ever been in our service system before. We're contacted. We get involved with the county that provides the services to develop a service plan so that person can be relocated to someplace that's safe. They may or may not come into our state-operated program. Many, again, do not. We'll go into other community programs. We then have, to further complicate the issue, several hundred individuals with developmental disabilities in state prisons as well, and we typically sit down with corrections and sort of look at that group and at least in some cases plan services when they come out under parole and supervision.
Okay, so we're talking about a group. Part of this group are people that have done their time, they did a crime, they've done their time, but they're very dangerous people and have mental situations that require them to because they've done their time, they're no longer in jail, but they can't just be released, given $50, and, they have to sort of followed around and but not placed in the mental hospital. Is that, when you say that they're in need of care, but you're trying to transition them, what does that mean?
Mr. Chairman, if a person has done their time and come out of the forensic unit of the state hospital or come out of the prison even and finished their time, legally we cannot incarcerate those individuals, but some of those individuals from our perspective still pose a major risk if they are not supervised. Simply doing parole for someone whose intelligence may not be very high, may be very affected by street youth or gangs and unduly influenced, that needs protection, then either within a state-operated program or in a community program, we will sometimes put together some pretty high-cost plans for the supervision of those individuals. So that is correct.
Wow.
Well,
Weston.
Mr. Chair, the thing that got me is when you said jails, like our community corrections programs, we're keeping, I mean, half my question is, we're keeping some severely retarded or disabled individuals in community corrections? I mean, that was the implication of your statement.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westland, in most cases, people that have committed crimes are not people with real severe retardation. They will typically be more in the mild to borderline retardation.
To go into these intensive group homes, that's the population I'm talking about. Your statement was they're coming out of jails going into these
correct
intensive community group homes.
Correct.
I don't get that. I still don't get that. If you're talking about coming out of the forensics population, okay, I get that. I mean,
okay, would you mind just explaining why is it that some of criminals that are incarcerated come out and go into a $270,000 to $280,000 a year cost situation of being in a community-operated facility or state-operated small-size facility?
Mr. Chairman, if an individual has committed murder or rape or other very serious kinds of personal assault and...
They're not in a jail. They're in prison.
In some cases, Mr. Chairman, Senator Westland, they've committed a crime at the local level and ended up in jail for a period of time, and then local corrections and the county mental health and developmental disability program works to develop an option for that person, and in some cases that involves increased funding from the state to provide the adequate supervision for that individual. So they may not come through the state criminal corrections system at all. They just were dealt with locally, ended up in a county jail, and then came to us. Or they could have been in our service system before and reoffended, went into a local jail for a period of time, and then the determination is made that they need a much higher level of security and placement.
Is there any model that you're aware of where the care can be rendered but at a lesser expense or more efficiently?
Mr. Chairman, often for a lot of these individuals, number one, community providers won't serve them because they're very concerned about their own liability and risk. So, or if they will serve them, they will demand rates almost as high. In some cases, we actually have a few individuals in the community that have rates higher than the state operator rate, if you can believe that, with very intense security and supervision needs. So, again, a lot of states still deal with parts of these population in their institutions. Oregon, made different choices. And so we serve some individuals with very intense needs. And our state-operated program, when you think out of the developmental disabilities population, we probably have about 5,000 people in 24-hour care of some sort. And so 140 or so cases is a very small number. The cost is huge, but in terms of the state's capacity to be sort of the final backstop when individuals fail or can't be relocated anywhere else, it's a duty that falls back on us.
So the answer is no.
Mr. Chairman, I think we've in the deinstitutionalization of Fairview and the closure of our institutions over time, and I think we've cut to the margins. I mean, I think there comes a point where you have to really be concerned about public safety and whether we've cut too deep to the margins, and I think we've tried to do a clear balancing act of providing some very intense services for a small group. But again, in our crisis and diversion program out in the community, we often enhance rates significantly for people who otherwise would pose a risk as well.
Well, now this is an area that most of us are not familiar with, and so the last few months have been an education. And all I'm asking is, you've looked at other programs, other ways that it's being handled in other states, and that this is the best that we can do. I mean, if that's the case, that's the case.
Mr. Chairman, In other states, every state wrestles with this issue. It's been the subject of many conferences. What do you do with developmental disability offenders that don't really fit in jail or are very costly, and what kinds of support? And I don't think anybody clearly has the answer to this.
Understand. Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If these folks, that some of them come, say, from a county jail, or maybe even come directly from Department of Corrections, are they getting a level of service in those facilities much higher than the normal inmate in those facilities? I mean,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanna, I believe there is still, does Shangri-La still operate the program at State Pen? I know Corrections had set up some specialized training and programs for people with developmental disabilities in the state prison. And, of course, for those who end up in the forensic unit, there's mental health and other kinds of treatment there. So I think the answer is yes.
I'm just questioning because all these questions come up. I mean, we're serving in those type of facilities the general population somewhere between $25,000 and $40,000 a year, and then to have them come out of there and go to a $260,000 a year program or 70, it seems like we better go back and look at the DOC model, however it is they're providing that care, and see if there isn't a transitional model rather than going directly from jail/prison care to the most expensive care possible. And it's just a thought that we ought to be taking a hard look at.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanna, I agree. The only thing I would say again here is in the state-operated program, we serve some very high-profile folks. Again, I mean, the overall numbers are pretty small compared to the numbers of people in corrections or even the number of people in 24-hour care. And when their time is done, we can't incarcerate them. And if they just went out typically under a parole scenario, may not have a living setting to which they can return and simply are on the street, then I think the likelihood that they would reoffend would be very, very high. So it's we're caught in between.
Yeah, that's fine. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'm ready to go to the spreadsheet if that's the wish of the committee.
Okay, which spreadsheet are we looking at?
This is the the breakdown of each of the program areas, the cost, the average cost, the number of people served.
That'd be on phase two, detailed budget breakdown.
I don't know where
here,
this...
It's where, is. Wherever you put it in your book. we receive this...
It's wherever you put it or not.
Yeah.
Well, I'm trying to find it for Jackie.
Or not.
Oh, but that might be a disheveled comment after a while.
Uh-huh.
This one...
Here. 103.
Thank you.
Okay, while they're looking, let's follow up on a comment you made last week. We were discussing the cap and the consequences of the cap, and made that it didn't seem wise to defund Oregon Project Independence at a time where institution of a cap would result in additional people that may need additional services to help them stay in their home because they'd be on a waiting list. And there was a comment made, I'm going passive voice so nobody has to own it, that $15 million might have been appropriate amount to be funded toward OPI with the idea that with a cap, you know, there's going to need to be some additional revenues, but that the governor's recommended budget actually unfunded completely. And so I'm looking at page 2 on our 1 of 8 handout where it talks about OPI and would like to have some thoughts on whether or not it might actually be appropriate, and this is without consideration of the lack of the match. I mean, I know that that's a huge issue, but I'm just talking about models for delivery of service to actually expand OPI to handle disabled and not just elderly. What are your thoughts on that, knowing what you know about the way the program functions and the volunteers and the leveraging of local resources?
Mr. Chairman, and I know we have some very strong advocates on Oregon Project Independence in the room here, the program from our perspective is a very valuable program and has lots of potential. And it has been of concern that it does not include people with disabilities. And the reasons are varied, but when this program was piloted, I think in 1975, it was purely set up as a program for the elderly. I know there's been a lot of concern that if you add people with disabilities with the same dollar amount, you're just thinning the soup for additional individuals. I think eventually it should include people with disabilities as well, because in many cases they have the same in-home needs for those individuals who otherwise aren't Medicaid eligible. Our thinking during the original budget preparation process, as we set caps and did all the other reductions in service, was that it would be very good to have sort of a safety valve in the community program. It's general fund only. There are no federal obligations. The program is capped. Each area has an allocation. If they overspend their allocation, there's nothing else that we do in terms of adding additional dollars, so it's not a mandated caseload. And I think over time, our AAAs and community programs have done a very good job of providing minimal supports to people. I think the typical payment is benefit is about $130 or $150 a month, with a little bit of case management, a small amount of administration on top of that. So it is very cost effective, and I think it would be a good safety valve. And that's why we, during one of the budget development phases, actually boosted it to $15 million, which is actually only about $2 or $3 million over where it was some years ago before the reduction started. And the reason, again, that fell down to nothing and even down through the floor was we just couldn't get to our general fund targets. And, of course, this is all general fund. And all the other reductions we were making, usually we lost federal match, which just magnified the size of the reduction. So it was purely the math that we got to at the end that said we can't get to this general fund target. And that's when the mistake was made from an earlier budget iteration of $15 million, and the thought was that it was being cut to the 3.9 of the maintenance of effort. So 11-something was taken out when there was only 8-point-something in it to begin with. So that's how we made that mistake. If we go forward with OPI in any form in the future, I think given everything else that's happening in the budget, it is time to rethink it. The Oregon Project Independence Modernization Bill that's in the legislature, I think, plants some very good seeds in that direction, and the addition of people with disabilities and allowing some of those funds to start doing the big public outreach for retirement and financial planning and promoting long-term care insurance and things of that sort, I think, is very good. So depending where that program goes, yes, I think it can serve a useful role in a sort of a safety valve.
Thank you. Okay, why don't we have you kind of guide us through this?
Mr. Chairman, this walks through again the sub-A budget categories in which a lot of things are rolled up. And we'll just walk through quickly the in-home program, the client-employed provider program. You see both the change in numbers from the current caseload downward to from over 12,000 to a little over 11,000 in the governor's recommended budget. The average monthly cost per case that goes from a little over 1,000 to 1,176. What that includes is only the roll-up from last biennium to this. That does not include what's in the bargaining pot and could be added as a part of collective bargaining because that's in a separate area. So this simply includes the roll-up from 03-05 into the next biennium. Other care.
I'd like to have Mr. Britton comment on that.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, I think what you're saying, James, is that during the 03-05 session, legislative session, the budget received $25 million general fund federal match to implement the in-home care workers contract.
Correct.
And the roll-up of that is from, I think it was for April 04 through the end of this biennium, that was biennialized. In other words, to make it to 24 months, there was a modest amount of inflation or cost of living adjustment. But there is an additional $20 million of general fund included in the governor's budget as a special purpose appropriation to the emergency fund for additional cost of benefits for the home care workers. And the $20 million and its potential federal match is not included in these numbers.
Correct.
Okay.
Okay, and the numbers of average monthly population between that which existed November 04 to the 850 or so less anticipated for 05-07, would you just clarify the justification for that for me?
Mr. Chairman, for the number going down, again, it's in the governor's recommended budget because of the cap.
The waiver cap.
I mean, the waiver cap.
The cap would do that?
Mm-hmm. Correct. Now, again, these numbers will be reshot in the governor's reshoot, so these numbers will look different when you get both the rebalance and the governor's reshoot. But this is at time of GRB. This was the estimated number.
It's just not real clear to me. If as of November 04, there was 12,552, and then we have all of 05 for appreciation, and we have 400 a month coming out and 800 coming in, so you know, that sounds like roughly 4,800 more, plus this was November, so now we're at 5,200 additional people. Is that correct? 400 times? No, because you have some people coming out, so it's not like it's flat and only increasing. Whatever the number is, as of 12/31/05, it's going to be higher than it was in November of 04, and then we're putting a cap in, and yet the numbers are 850 less for the biennium when we're starting off at several thousand, or at least 2,000 to 4,000 more. Well, if you have four coming out, it actually is over 4,000, isn't it? I mean, if it's 5,000 people, if you have four coming out every month and 800 coming in. Am I confusing what we're talking about here?
Mr. Chairman, it's hard to explain. Part of what's going on here is this caseload was declining virtually all biennium. If you remember in phase one and we looked at the different charts, the in-home program took a very steep dive after levels 14 through 17 were cut out and then started again to increase. So for pretty much throughout the biennium, and we could show you a trend line on that, the numbers were decreasing. And that trend was continuing as of November 04 at the rebalance. The numbers that will come back in rebalance and the reshoot will actually start showing an increase. But the cap, as one would expect, would fall most heavily on the in-home program. And those are the people with lesser impairments that would probably have to wait the longest to get into service. So I think the combination of what historically were declining caseloads after the original cuts in 2003-05, mitigated by now the caseload increases, and wherever that cap is set will give you a true number.
Okay. I mean, wait for the reshoot, and see how it goes.
Mr. Chairman, other care is just a whole series of things. It includes adult daycare, home-delivered meals, minor home adaptation, personal care for someone who is categorically eligible at 100% of SSI or below as a state plan option, not as part of the home and community-based waiver. They're eligible for 20 hours of personal care. And there is also part of the in-home program here that is not part of the home care worker program. We also have contracts with in-home health agencies in the state that provide in-home care for certain individuals. So that's all of those programs rolled up into a category called other care. And it shows the average group and the average monthly cost per case.
Okay, now, how is this impacted by the Older Americans Act?
Mr. Chairman, this does not include the Older Americans Act program.
Okay, because I see a lot of similarities between these programs and the ones that are discussed in Older Americans Act.
Older American Act programs, Mr. Chairman, are services to the public at large. They're not primarily to a Medicaid population. For the most part, these, again, are individuals that are part of the home and community-based waiver, part of the Medicaid program.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Winters.
Has there been any discussion nationally or any input from our state in perhaps looking at the inclusion of an Oregon Project Independence type under the Older Americans Act?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Winters, I know Senator Wyden is, who was here in the early days when OPI was originally founded, has talked about that off and on. I don't think there's anything in the reauthorization of the Older Americans Act that really includes an OPI-like program for the public at large. Again, I think the assumption has been that at least if you're Medicaid eligible through the waivers, you can get in-home care and other services of that type. But I don't know of anything that's being looked at in the Older Americans Act around this at this time. And I think the act is up for reauthorization this session of Congress.
So it doesn't behoove us not to maybe have some input back into Congress or some discussion back with Congress to talk about the issue and maybe the merits of that being placed under the Older Americans Act.
Okay. If I could get with a letter, I would like to write Levitt and the legislative liaison at the White House, because it is a good model. I mean, you know, they're struggling like the rest of us, and I think that it would be appropriate for us to have some contact to try and promote greater interest in that, which it's a good model. It's just we hate to do it without the match. And they have the same concerns with an aging population across America that we have in our state. So.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Richardson, I know through the leadership of Senator Smith, they're certainly going to look at the Medicaid program and probably the waivers and where that program should go. But again, I've heard of nothing in a OPI-like program for a non-Medicaid eligible population. I don't even think it's on anybody's drawing board at this point.
Because it's additional. It's an additional population.
It's an additional population, Mr. Chairman, and the big concern is the rising costs of Medicaid. And
we got, yeah.
And how are we going to contain the growth of that program given the population demographics? So I think that's going to focus most of their attention here in the next couple of years, as it should. And
I also think that you're correct on looking at the rising population, but I think there's also the look at a vehicle to where we're not moving totally towards institutionalized care, but how can we keep this rising population in their own homes?
Well, many states don't have the options that we have here, and so they basically have rest home option. And so at those costs, an OPI model would actually save the federal government's money.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, Senator Winter is in the President's budget. One of the key issues they're trying to address in the Medicaid program is called the money follows the person, where, if, assuming this passes, states would be able to move people out of institutional facilities, nursing homes, institutions for people with mental retardation, and those types of programs, and collect full 100% federal match for the first year after relocation. So it would be a big incentive for states because, again, the chairman is right. Most states, or many states, still spend the vast majority of their dollars and serve most of their people in institutional care, unlike Oregon and Washington and a handful of other states. So that's one of the attempts in the President's budget, at least, to try to create that incentive. I'm sure that would be accompanied by bed caps behind them as people leave, or you'd have people just cycling people through institutions so they could move them out and get the full 100% federal match. We're hopeful, actually, that that will pass, and I think it would not be as big a deal for Oregon because we've come so far down in our institutions and even in our nursing facilities. The average length of stay is very short. Most people are in and out in 30 days or so, but that's not true in most of the country. So that small little proposal, I think, would be a great boon around the country to start rebalancing state systems.
Yeah, I think the average for private pay is pretty quick. The average for state funded is longer. I didn't think it was 30 days, but I know what you mean.
So,
okay.
Mr. Chairman, on page 2, of course, Oregon Project Independence is zeroed out in a deficit for the governor's recommended budget. Moving to DD support services, most of this is the STALEY, is the in-home supports and support of individuals in the community that are not living in 24-hour care, but it also includes family support services, children's intensive services for some of the medically fragile kids that are in their own programs. Number continues to grow as we phase in. We'll phase in over 1,000 individuals, new individuals, in 2005, 2007 under STALEY. Since this is such a big number and it rolls up, we tried to break down between 2003-05 and then 05-07 the average monthly rates for each of those programs. So hopefully that provides some explanation of the bigger number.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Senator Montes.
Just so that I understand this, so when you say 2003-05 and you have the average monthly population STALEY 2687, and then 2005 to 2007, you have the average monthly population STALEY 4143. That is the increase of those eligible or considered under the STALEY program, then?
Correct.
Double, almost. Not quite.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, this entitlement, this settlement continues to phase in. It will continue through, I think, 2009 until all individuals are served. And again, last biennium, during the reductions, we stopped enrollments actually for about 6 months, and had we probably would have been in breach of the agreement and gone back to court, but we then renegotiated with the plaintiffs and then started enrollments again. But yes, this continues to phase in over the next several biennia.
And follow up. And I don't know much about it. I just remember reading it somewhere that there was another state that the courts overturned this type of service to these patients. Do you know anything about other states that are trying to deal with this population?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Montes Anderson, the state of Washington recently, and I don't know at what appellate level that was, the court rejected a similar case, but it was really filed on different grounds. Washington and several other states have tried to argue that there is an entitlement to the home and community-based waiver. And the courts typically have rejected that because the courts have said the entitlement is actually to institutional care. I mean, it's perverse, but under how the waivers and federal law is formulated, the entitlement is to institutional care. The litigation that was brought in Oregon actually alleged that people, that this vast group of individual was entitled to institutional care. The original demand of the plaintiffs was that we enroll 9,000, I can't remember the number, but thousands of people into 24-hour care, which would have cost a fortune. And then we renegotiated a settlement based on providing non-24-hour care, although people, and again, this gets rather technical, but everybody on the waiver side still eligible for institutional care. But the plaintiffs said they would not assert that right as long as we were providing services in the community to their families, to people with disabilities living in their own homes. And if they reached a full crisis state where the family collapsed or the person could no longer live on their own, they could still enter on a crisis basis into 24-hour care. But the Staley Agreement essentially split the system in two, 24-hour care with lots of caps in terms of crisis, and then the entitlement was pushed out on the non-24-hour side. But I think that was the difference in the litigation that asserted a right to community services instead of institutional services.
Would follow up? Would our
you emailed me that.
Does our state want to look at that, or is that just too much of a political nightmare?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I'm not sure what you're asking.
I understand all of the ramifications, but if between, I'm still not quite sure the difference with the litigation of Washington that Washington had. They then ended up not having to serve that population.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, again, I think they are expanding services for people on their waiting list. They just rejected the litigation, as I understand it, and I haven't looked at all the details of the case. But again, the legal claim was that people had a right to community-based care, and the courts have typically said federal law says you have a right to institutional care, but the states can, through home and community-based waivers, divert people that otherwise would go into institutional care and keep them in the community and receive federal match under the Medicaid program. So in this case, instead of asserting a legal claim that these people are not served at all, they have a right to institutional care, and oh, by the way, the state can settle the agreement by providing services in the community like Oregon did, in Washington, they didn't even assert the institutional claim. They just asserted a right to community-based services. Mm-hmm. So one might say that the plaintiffs didn't think it through real clearly, because in most cases in states that alleged a right to institutional care and with agreements that ended up with a community settlement, it was okay. Similar to the Oregon case.
Yes, I didn't realize the differentiation with institutional care and community-based care. Or in-home care.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Monson, I mean, this is this unique feature of federal law where the entitlement for long-term care remains an institutional entitlement, not an entitlement on the community side. And we've lived with that now since 1981 or so, and there's been many, many attempts, and there will be again in this session of Congress to change that. But again, that's been the legal formulation for many, many years. There are, I'm sort of going afield here, but there are repeated attempts to actually separate and to say that qualification for institutional care ought to have its separate criteria with its own utilization controls, and then instead of funding all these services under waivers against institutional care, the states ought to be able to do a state plan amendment under Medicaid, which you simply say this is the population we choose to serve, the type of services that we are willing to offer, this is how much we can afford, and get out of this whole institutional trap. But at some point, I think Congress will move in that direction, but until now, it's sort of fallen on deaf ears.
Okay, thank you. Next, we have the East Oregon Training Center.
Mr. Chairman, moving on to Eastern Oregon Training Center, you'll see the facility there. It is our only remaining state institution for people with mental retardation. Originally designed in the early 80s to house about 90, 95 people, it's now down to 45 individuals. We relocated another five. We had a crisis unit for people with intense crises that we transitioned back to the Salem area under the state-operated community program, since the vast majority of people that went through that program were from the Valley, and it would seem much better to support them here. So this facility is now down to 45 individuals. You see the number of positions and the average monthly cost per case. It's a close approximation to the costs of the state-operated community program.
If these numbers, of course, you know, I mean, if one person moves, that doesn't mean the numbers come down at all, right? Because it's not like you lay someone off or that you cut down a wing if one person changes. So, I mean, it's hard to derive accurate ideas or trends based on a small change in a population when you have a facility to maintain. But even at 45, I've looked at the demographics as far as how many are long-term, how many short-term, how many are multiple, and have been in, released, come back, and there is quite a turnover there. And I'm wondering, is there any discussion about, out of the 45, a number that could be in regular kind of group homes rather than in this facility, because a regular local, you know, DD group home is going to be a lot cheaper to maintain than this facility. So I'm wondering if 45 is where it needs to be, or could it be actually 25 and there'd be significant savings? And I've never been there, so I don't know if the change in population would really make a difference in the cost. Like, you have wings like East Oregon Psychiatric Center and the governor's recommendation of closing down a ward. I mean, there's a substantial savings if that were to happen because you've got a block that's not going to be manned anymore. But I don't know how it works here.
Mr. Chairman, this particular facility is a relatively stable population. We've had very few, other than the crisis unit that was located there and that was relocated to the Valley, we've had very, very few new admissions. So it's sort of a stable population that just is slowly starting to decline as people age out or die. And Eastern Oregon runs its own set of crisis services in the community, so they've been quite successful in diverting new admissions to institutional care. So I think this population will continue to creep down over time. There are several factors in terms of its future. One is you have to have an intermediate care facility for people with mental retardation to have a waiver. But some states have created simply a very small 5 or 10 bed ICFMR, and it appears to have satisfied the federal government that you still have something you call an institution, ironically, so that you can fund all your community services as a waiver against that. I think that's one factor. Another factor in terms of us thinking about the future is not knowing where Oregon State Hospital is going to settle out. We have people with mental retardation or developmental disabilities, as we described in the forensic unit at Oregon State Hospital. If that place closes or changes substantially, then maintaining an institutional structure in Pendleton may well be the best route. And so that's part of our thinking, that we shouldn't jump ahead here and make any changes real quickly. So
when that report is due, I understood it was due in May, in February, and now it's May, and so I'm wondering when that report's coming up.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think that report will make any specific recommendations about this, but as we look long-term then at the future of OSH, if we indeed need forensic capacity on the developmental disability side, this might be a part of the way to resolve it. I don't know. I can't predict that at this point in time. All I can say. Sorry.
I've been meeting. I attend one meeting where we were talking about the report, and the House Health Policy Committee and the Senate Policy Committee are going to meet on a Monday during this hour to have that report, and we were going to extend an invitation to this committee, too. We'll talk about that later.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, again, I mean, obviously, this facility at 45 people and this cost will not remain as is indefinitely into the future. But I think if we're going to do something different with it, it's going to require a planning process. This is a major employer in the Pendleton area. So there's lots of issues that I think we need to sort through before we sort of go to the next stage.
And I'm not suggesting anything, just getting clarification.
Correct. In terms of your comment, though, in terms of the acuity or the complexity of care of the people left at Eastern Oregon Training Center, many of the individuals we relocated when we closed Fairview actually have equal or higher acuity levels or complexity of care levels of people remaining in Pendleton. So it's not an issue of capacity over time. We would have to develop the capacity, but that's not the issue for us.
Thank you.
And just one other clarification I would like. I see the average monthly cost per case for 0305 is $18,000, and for 0507 it's going to be almost $22,000 per case per month. Is that comparable to the costs at the psych hospitals here on their geriatric unit, or I'm just trying to get a feeling, because I can't remember what the numbers per costs when we were talking about other programs. Is this more than any other system?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Monisand, I think it's higher than most of the costs in the psychiatric facilities. The developmental disabilities institutions have tended to be much costlier because of very extensive federal requirements. This is also a full federal program with full federal match. You'll see in large parts of the state hospital, other than kids and people in the geropsych units, we can't collect Medicaid. This is a full-blown Medicaid program. It's one of the most heavily regulated programs in the country, so that the costs have tended to be quite a bit higher. We could certainly give you a comparison, but I think they're substantially higher.
Thank you.
Moving on, Mr. Chairman, the nursing facilities. This is pretty much self-explanatory. You see the average population. It shows a continuing decline from last biennium going into next biennium. Again, these numbers will change somewhat in the caseload reshoot of the governor's budget. The level of decline appears to be declining. Oregon's been on a 25-year journey of continuing decline in nursing facility beds, and I think that's slowly starting to bottom out. I think there's lots of reasons for that. Oregon's population itself is growing. The elderly population is growing. Most of the actual lengths of stay in nursing facilities are coming down, and so people are using these facilities legitimately for post-hospital and convalescent care. So I think we will see a stabilization of that number over time and not a continued decline.
President Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That population is declining, and we don't have a lot of history here to look at, but has the rate of increase in the cost per case been going up at this pace in the most recent history? You're looking at 20% plus cost increase. Has it been on that same trend?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanna, until several years ago, Oregon had one of the lowest nursing home reimbursement rates around the country. But last session, we passed the tax, the provider tax, and that's increased the rates from $111 a day to $137, then to $155, and I think ultimately next biennium will end up somewhere around $165 a day. Much of that's been fueled by the tax itself, because we tax close to 6% of their net revenue and then we take that out, we match it, put it back into the quality fund, and then allows these facilities to be reimbursed at a higher rate. So most of that's been fueled by the tax, some of it by increases in general fund.
Assuming that the facility has a high percentage of reimbursed clients, but if you're, I assume that there's facilities out there that don't have a high percentage that aren't real happy about having those increases.
Mr. Chairman, well, we tax everybody, the Medicaid and non-Medicaid beds, so correct.
So private pay?
Private pay has gone up. Moving to page 4 of 8, non-institutional care. This is excluding the in-home program. This is the rest of long-term care. It excludes in-home and it excludes nursing facilities. So this is everything in the middle. It's foster care, both relative and commercial foster care, residential care facilities, assisted living, specialized living facilities, Providence Elder Place, the PACE program that we talked about is all lumped in this category. You see the average monthly population declining here. Again, these numbers will change in the reshoot of the caseload, but that fairly steep decline from over 11,000 to about 9,000 is a combination of the waiver cap, the cut to about 1,900 people in relative foster care, and the rate decrease is in large part both relative foster care program going away and the cuts to the assisted living program.
Okay. I have a question. Over the weekend, I was talking with a proprietor of an adult foster care home about issues that affect the front lines. And she said, 2 years ago, my liability coverage, she has like, you know, three or four people, so it's, you know, under five. Her liability coverage to maintain her home was $1,800. Last year, it was $4,000. And she said that she is aware of some areas, some groups that have a little bit larger ones that are $10,000. And if you have four elderly people living in your home and you're caring for them, that kind of increase is absolutely horrendous. Is that widespread? Or are you familiar with what's going on as far as insurance rates for, you know, these care facilities?
Mr. Chairman, we're very concerned about both the steep increases and in some cases just the loss of liability insurance where carriers won't even cover. We have very few carriers even left that will insure this kind of program in this population. We've had extensive discussions with the insurance commissioner, looked at possible legislative approaches, couldn't really find a formulation that would work. This time around, we're now actually talking and negotiating with Lloyd's of London as a potential carrier that could come in with more reasonable rates. We don't see litigation or situations in Oregon that have fueled that kind of cost. It appears to be more of a national trend, but many, many providers don't even get insurance, and we're quite worried that the effect of that, it could also ripple into their homeowner's policy. Some people falsely believe that their homeowners will cover if something happens and the insurer finds out it was a commercial foster home. They may not even honor the homeowner's policy by saying you should have had liability insurance. So it's a very complicated issue. We actually had a bill this session, Senate Bill 174. I don't think it's going to make it out of committee. That would have at least guaranteed that the carriers had to continue homeowners insurance, even if the provider did not have liability insurance. The industry wasn't terribly pleased about that, understandably, but I think we're continuing to explore this, and it is a crisis, and we have to come up with... We've also looked at risk pools and how we could capitalize sort of a self-insurance program, and I think we'll probably continue exploring that.
PLF model?
We've looked at three or four different kinds of models. I can't name them off the top of my head.
Liability fund, the attorneys in Oregon are required to all have insurance through a state, kind of a state-sponsored program that's now quasi. But anyway, our rates are some of the lowest in the country because it's spread out over, you know, 7,000, however number of attorneys there are. And instead of you know, just whoever has it, whoever doesn't have it, and that model's being looked at by physicians right now because right. of the cost increases. Contractors are also having this kind of problem. If you build two houses, you have this huge insurance that you have to pay for, and the rates are just skyrocketing. Right. And so in this area, it is our area, and it's a policy issue, really, but we're all concerned about making sure that we look ahead. And when you're going from that kind of a percentage, you know, towards more than doubling in 1 year, and they had no claims, then how far does it go before we do take action? And so I'm pleased to hear that it's being considered. I'm just wondering what recommendations you might have, and maybe we could have this conversation as to really where it's at, because I would like to be a moving force, if at all possible, okay. to try and bring this to a head early rather than responding to the fact that these places are, you know, small adult foster homes are going out of business. They're just having to shut down because they can't make any money after they pay for their overhead. And so yeah. I'd like to...
And Mr. Chairman, there's simply a lot of homes that are uncovered at this point. They're simply not covered. And they go on without liability insurance at all, and that's not a good thing either. So.
Right. Okay.
DD Comprehensive Services, that's all of the 24-hour programs. Roll together, and you see over 5,000 individuals served there. The costs are the full package of 24-hour care, so that would include often your group homes or sheltered living situations, transportation, a day program, like a vocational program, all wrapped into that, those average costs. On page 5, state-operated community programs, you've seen that one already. The DD Community Housing Fund, I think we've talked about earlier, but it really consists of four different accounts, of which one is the Fairview Housing Trust Fund, which are the proceeds from the sale of Fairview, which under the legislation that was created at the time created a permanent trust that we could use 5% of the corpus initially, and then the interest thereafter in perpetuity to do grants, small grants for housing to community providers or families. And that program has been launched in the last couple of years, and I think we're expecting another payment on that fund eventually. The sale, I think, was $15 million that should accrue, although if they pay it off earlier, it will be something less than that.
Okay. Now, I just was asking why it went from $13,400,000 to $11,000,000. And my recollection now is that there was some debt that was paid off or that has lowered the cost but doesn't reduce the amount of actual benefit that's going out. Is this correct?
Well, we're still sort of trying to figure out how these numbers added up. But, yes, we did decrease. We did increase by $2 million. It was part of the governor's recommended budget. Where we had paid off our debt service on the bonds for some of the homes. We always had a 5-year note on these homes, and we had paid off many of those, and so there was a $2 million savings there. But we still, in the other parts of this overall housing fund, we have a maintenance and repair fund to honor the bond holders. We have to keep up the portfolio. We built probably over 200 homes as we closed Fairview and expanded community programs. Most of them funded through the housing agency, through the general obligation bond. So to honor the bondholder, we have to keep up a maintenance and repair fund because the use of these homes is pretty rigorous and they often need a lot of repairs. We also are doing some expanded development still for a small group under the Staley agreement that had access to 24-hour care on a non-crisis basis as a result of Staley. We still then have the notes that we're still paying off. So those different funds all end up in this aggregate housing fund.
Okay.
Older Americans Act, Mr. Chairman, is sort of self-explanatory. There's not really an average monthly population there per se, but it includes lots of things, lots of community outreach, education, support to caregivers, many of the meal sites in the senior centers is all part of that program. On page 6, the general assistance program, again, that's zeroed out in the 0507 budget.
What is the
the total cost for that? Do you have any idea? I mean, I know what the number is here. My understanding is that if we were to reinstate that, it also provides Oregon Health Plan benefits and other benefits that result from qualifying for general assistance. Have you any total numbers as to the cost to Oregon of having the general assistance program in place?
Mr. Chairman, I think we repriced that. It wasn't 4.7 million for next biennium. We can get you that exact number. And I think Mr. Britton had asked us earlier to send some repricing over on that. I don't know if we've done that or not, but we showed actually, if we did that, we'd show an increase from about 400 to 700 clients, and that would include the monthly cash, $314, plus health plan, plus for a subset of those folks that actually end up in long-term care during that time, since they're presumptively eligible for SSI, then we would cover the long-term care costs during that period, too.
Okay.
The OSIP program, Oregon Supplemental Income Program, again, this is our maintenance of effort. It's a little confusing here because you'll see the average monthly cost per case is, for this biennium, is $7.54, when the OSIP payment is actually $1.70 a month, which was our maintenance of effort. But also included in this are those other services that categorically eligible people can receive, including shelter maintenance, shelter costs associated with accessibility, in some cases costly items that they have to purchase because of their disability, that type of thing, are part of the special needs budget, which we talked about last week, where we've brought it from over $300,000 to about $250,000 a month, which actually is the reason for the decline then in the monthly cost per case from 0305 to 0507.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Primarily, we're using this program because we're required to by maintenance of effort. Is there any other way that we could shift the money into other types of assistance for low income and still get credit for the maintenance of effort?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, I don't think so. Because, again, this was tied when the federal SSI legislation passed. Each state had to sort of benchmark their maintenance of effort. A lot of states actually had a much, much higher threshold than Oregon. So I think this is...
Hope so.
it's $1.70 a month, but it's directly tied.
It doesn't go as far now as it used to.
Not quite, yeah. But, again, those individuals typically are eligible for a lot of other services, so it's the key is not the $1.70 dollars a month. It's the gateway into the rest of the system. So
I've learned more about this than I really wanted to. There was a bill that's come out to clarify some wording in the statutes, and it's quite a thick bill. And it says, in the summary, creates Oregon Supplemental Income Program. And I said, what? So I'm reading this whole bill trying to figure out what program is being created and who's trying to back this, only to find out that it was to clarify the current wording in some old statutes. Since then, the bill, the lead-in summary is being changed so that it doesn't quite say it that way.
Mr. Chairman, we were not creating a new program.
I understand that the drafters have consequences, too. Yes, Representative Hansen, Jay.
Thank you. If we could go back for a second for general assistance, I'm still concerned in terms of if the state is reimbursed by the retroactive lump sum payments, where the $4.9 million in 0507, what are we actually getting for that? If that's the administrative cost of the program, if that's people that that end up not being eligible for SSI, or I'd still be very interested in a breakdown of where that $4.9 million comes from. The other question, and I think, I'm sorry I had to attend two other committee meetings because I had bills up, but very early in your remarks this morning, you mentioned as you were going over the FTE of your department that you had the unit that actually determined eligibility for SSI?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen. Each state has a contract with the federal government for a disability determination unit. In the old Department of Human Services, it was attached to vocational rehabilitation. In the reorganization, it came to us. It's about a 200 staff unit. It's located out on Lancaster Drive, and they process thousands and thousands of cases. And it's all federally funded, 100% federal fund.
Could you find for me the average length of time that it takes for them to determine eligibility? I know we've got some real questions in terms of how long it takes the federal government to recognize these cases, and I'm looking to see if the slow up is in our end of the decision-making process or the federal end.
Yeah.
But if you could give me the duration of how long average case it takes for them to determine eligibility.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, I'll be pleased to do that. Actually, our rates have come way down the length of time. We got this unit just got a major award from the Social Security Commissioner because of that. But they are also, with great angst, but nonetheless proceeding to a paperless system over time where all of the work will be done electronically. And of course, now we're sort of doing parallel tracks of both paper systems and electronic systems. And I don't know what that means for the length of time per case. But Oregon's unit has shown remarkable progress in the last couple of years in bringing those cases down. And in fact, we then had to start doing work since we were doing such a good job doing work for Idaho and other states that were falling behind. And so, but we'll be happy to provide that for you.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay. Then, Mr. Chairman, just pages 7 and 8. And again, I'll get you that detailed breakdown of all the puts and takes on positions, but here the positions are rolled up in the two areas. Program support, about 1,008 positions for the governor's recommended budget for 2005-07, and that includes the whole field for the senior and disability program that is operated directly by the state. All the payments for the county programs, the AAAs and all that are shown at the bottom as special payments, so that doesn't show up as personnel. That goes out the door as special transfer payments to local government. And included in program support are all the licensing staff. Under federal law, we have to do all the licensing and certification for nursing homes and all the other facilities. So the non-sort of administrative staff, are, including the field, are wrapped up in that number there.
Okay, Representative Hansen. Excuse me, Hannah.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned you just, I think, passed over the transfer staff issue and the equity portion. Can you explain that a little more? How that's going to come, or is this where we're talking about it, or is it coming later?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know, Representative Hannon, I don't know that it's coming later. It certainly has been a large issue between us and local government, and based on legislation passed last session, we actually had to come up with a formula in terms of how we decide exactly what the amount is that we pay to local government. I think what you'll hear from local government is at the time that a program was transferred from the state, because under state law, local government can decide to organize a senior and disability program. It's their choice, their right of first refusal, and they can operate the entire Medicaid program for both populations or for either population. Most now have moved towards both populations. At the time that we transfer the staff, the SNS, and all the bells and whistles that go with that, it's a pretty much across the board transfer. I think their concern is over time, what we actually transfer to them decreases because it has not kept pace with all the other increases that have typically occurred when you drive the formula off of state employees, and they end up getting cost of living adjustments and that type of thing, and treated almost like a contractor as opposed to just a straight-across government partner. And that, and so the issue around the equity gap is where that comes from. And we actually ran that formula for this biennium. We originally had a proposal in the budget that didn't make it into the final thing. I think the total gap now is about $9 million general fund between us and all the local governmental entities that do this. So that's not addressed in the transfer payments here. This is simply what's in the recommended.
Okay, Representative Hanna?
Well, just as a follow-up, because I don't totally understand this piece, will we see what that formula looks like? I mean, are we going to see what that formula looks like to how you came up with the $9 million gap?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanna will be pleased to show you both the administrative rule and the calculations that we used to come up with that.
Okay. Representative Henson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When the legislature addressed this last, it was last session that we addressed, and wasn't the legislative intent that we get total equity at this point?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Henson, the compromise legislation, the original bill, would have required the state to make up the gap. The bill, as it came out, directed us to work with the AAAs to develop a formula. So, because there were lots of debates on what that gap was with different arguments, and so we all got together and in good faith, I think, agreed to a process and a formula that I think most people agreed with. Then the legislation said that formula had to be used in developing a proposed budget package, not a required budget package, but something that we would develop a budget proposal for. We did that. We proposed to fund, I can't remember what percentage of that gap, half or up to 92% of that gap was the budget proposal that we came in with. It didn't make it into the final budget because of all the other reductions. So, again, assuming if nothing happens this biennium, we would repeat that formula. In the interim, we would identify the size of the gap that will probably have grown even farther than. We would put together a budget package for next biennium and repeat the process.
Well, that will certainly be helpful. It doesn't correct the gap, though, which was, I felt our intention all the way through was to try and get that gap closed down, which is significant when you're talking about $9 million that is in effect not going to some of the counties that have got significant portions. I mean, it's not, we can talk about it as a $9 million gap, but actually what it means is a service gap, that there are fewer dollars, fewer resources available for those counties that step forward that have ran the AAAs for a period of time.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanson, where it tends to play out is lower staffing ratios or higher staffing ratios, I should say, if you can't fund it at the same level. And, I mean, again, this is a major problem across the board for local government. It includes mental health and developmental disabilities and others that are not part of this formula, but similarly, I think when you hear from local government, they feel that we haven't sort of squared the costs 100% going both directions. So,
okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The information. We have public hearings the next 2 days. We have some additional information you're going to provide for us, which we'll get individually, and we can contact you for further clarification. So as of now, I think that you've given us everything that we can. And for those of us that remain in this committee, we, if there's no further comments, we'll go ahead and adjourn. Thank you, everybody.
Wait, please.
Yeah.